Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of KleptoCast, the podcast series from the Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative. My name is Casey Michelle, and our guest today is Erica Westenberg, who manages governance programs at the Natural Resource Governance Institute. Erica has worked extensively as an attorney for numerous energy and infrastructure-related projects, as well as helped with parliamentary oversight in the extractive industry. Erica also helps with NRGI's engagement with the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, known as the EITI, which is an organization dedicated to pushing oversight and transparency in the extractive sector. It's also a group Azerbaijan recently quit. So, Erica, it's great to have you with us today. As some of our listeners may be aware, the OECD recently named the extractive sector as the most corrupt industry globally. So before delving into the EITI itself, I was wondering if you could give us just a broad overview of the current state of transparency and oversight in the industry, especially any changes we may have seen over the past few years.
Thank you, Casey, and thanks so much for having me. I think it's definitely an issue that's gaining only increasing relevance in recent years and in this year in particular. Extractive resources are ones that are inherently complex and inherently of public interest because they are public resources. And the corruption risks associated with them are significant. And I think what's critical to keep in mind is there's always this balance of the sort of technocratic things, the elements of just good policy from a fiscal, economic, legal perspective, that transparency is very critical to getting right, to having that public monitoring, that public understanding of different policies, and oversight actors having the ability to evaluate the decisions that are made about these public resources. But there's, of course, also the conflict of interest, corruption, sometimes the more juicy, if you will, element of it. And that's what I think is so critical about transparency initiatives. It has to do both jobs, both the day-to-day, run-of-the-mill kind of technical information is critical, but also to actually get at these much more, oftentimes more challenging elements of the sector. And I think what we've learned over the years is that certainly transparency is part of the puzzle. It's a critical part of the puzzle, and I think there's growing acceptance that it's needed across the board, but it's only part of the puzzle. It will never have all of the answers, and what really becomes most important is what do you do with that information once it's disclosed? How are you making sure that it's being analyzed and used to actually inform policymaking.
Mm-hmm. Which I think brings me to my next question, just as it pertains to the EITI itself as an organization. Could you give us just a quick overview of how EITI itself works and maybe where it fits into the broader international oversight regime?
Sure. So EITI is a multi-stakeholder initiative, and the stakeholders involved are government, civil society, and companies. And this framework, this multi-stakeholder framework exists both at the international level with the EITI International Board, which is responsible for making global policy decisions about the initiative and the standard. But I think really critically, it's also replicated at national level. So countries, and there are now 50-odd countries that participate in EITI, drive those EITI processes at national level also through a multi-stakeholder group comprised of government, civil society, and companies. So that's kind of a key element of how the initiative works. It's a standard that now has become very comprehensive. So it started in the early 2000s, kind of out of emerging awareness of the kind of economic and governance challenges of natural resource and really driven by civil society demands for payment information and for that to be more transparent. But after several years of implementation of this relatively narrow kind of company payments reconciled with government receipts, it became clear that revenue information alone wasn't going to be sufficient to actually inform these complex policy debates. So in 2013, the EITI standard expanded to be much more comprehensive of kind of the entire extractive process. So it now covers everything from license allocations to revenue allocations as well. So it's the scope of it, I think, is much more comprehensive now, and that's made a big difference.
And we're not talking about only developed countries or developed states. I mean, this includes all the regions of globally, but also states like Nigeria and Mongolia and Peru.
Yep.
So I guess just moving from the broader theoretical underpinnings of what EITI was trying to do and some of the updates that have come through EITI, you know, like in 2013, as you mentioned, but moving to the more practical on-the-ground impacts, what are some of the what is the outgrowth of the efforts from EITI that we've seen on the ground? Are there any examples that that come to mind that are worth highlighting?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think if you ask the 50-odd EITI countries what the impact has been, you get a different answer in each country because all of the stakeholders come to it, I think, with different goals. And I think one of the strengths of the initiative has actually been its ability to serve different functions in different contexts. So on the one hand, I think you do have what I think probably was most expected when the initiative was set up, which is examples of countries through their EITI reporting process having disclosed information that, for instance, revealed revenues that were owed to the government, and the government was able to recoup revenues that they otherwise would have lost. That's a good example from Nigeria. You have examples from Tanzania where analysis of EITI data enabled at the subnational level, subnational government agencies and civil society to push for better allocations. So I think that's sort of what we envision maybe most typically about the impact. But I think there are really critical other types of impacts that shouldn't be discounted, such as the actual kind of cross-stakeholder dialogue part of it. If you look at the fact, like in countries like Myanmar, where, you know, having civil society, government, and companies sit down to have a discussion would have been unheard of. And EITI was actually able to bring these disparate stakeholders to the table, not saying the process is perfect, not in any respect saying that all of the issues have been resolved. Of course, they haven't. But just creating the platform for that type of interaction and that type of debate, I think is a pretty significant impact. And then there are still areas just in terms of, you know, establishing a global norm for transparency where I think the EITI is still pushing the envelope. Beneficial ownership disclosure is one of the newest full requirements in the EITI standard. And it's really pushing beneficial ownership information gathering has always been part of due diligence processes in various respects in the financial sector. The public disclosure element of it and actually opening that to public scrutiny and understanding is really pushing the frontiers on that critical issue. Same for things like contract transparency. A new report that we just published in RGI shows that now over half of EITI countries are disclosing licenses and contracts. So still pushing the envelope on kind of what is best practice for transparency in the sector.
So it's not very often that EITI in and of itself breaks into at least the American news cycle or maybe even broader Western news cycle. But this month did see some developments that pushed EITI into the news. As mentioned in the intro to this podcast, Azerbaijan recently just decided to pull out of the group outright. Without getting too into the weeds about the situation with EITI and Azerbaijan, can you talk just a bit about what prompted Baku to pull out and what this may mean for the EITI moving forward?
Sure. Azerbaijan's engagement in EITI has been one of the longest. They were a very early adopter of EITI and in many respects one of the most complex. And the complexity doesn't really come from the technical reporting side of it, but more from this multi-stakeholder element of it. One of the key parts of the EITI standard is a basic level of an enabling environment for civil society to participate in this process. So a civil society protocol exists that was strengthened in 2013 significantly, and some serious questions started emerging as part of that conversation around whether Azerbaijan had sufficient enabling environment for civil society engaging on natural resource governance issues. So you know, this has always been, I think, one of the most challenging areas for the EITI board to engage with, this concept of civic space and how far the initiative should go in terms of engaging with countries on these issues. So what we saw was really a years-long effort, multiple years-long effort, to give Azerbaijan every conceivable opportunity within the EITI's rules and standards and protocols to address these situations, which, of course, as we all know, are very, very serious situations for civil society on the ground there and very grave risks that they face. And it was only after these years of sort of opportunities and softer measures that the EITI board, after many assessments, took the decision that Azerbaijan would be suspended, which is a very common a common thing to occur in EITI. Dozens of EITI countries have been suspended, usually for very small reasons, like missing a deadline. And, you know, a country gets suspended and they come back in. And certainly the hope of Azerbaijan with suspension, because it was in line with the EITI's own rules and protocols, was that they would address these underlying issues and could continue to be part of the initiative. Unfortunately, after that suspension was issued by the board, the government made the decision to withdraw from the initiative, which I think everyone agrees is a very regrettable decision. I don't think it's what anyone wanted, and certainly from our perspective now, it does not mean the work is over. If anything, it means more work exists to be done. The principles of transparency and accountability and civic space don't go away, and all of us just have more work to do now with stakeholders on the ground there.
So it seems that Azerbaijan's decision, even though countries are from time to time suspended, Azerbaijan's decision in and of itself to pull out of the group wholesale was something of a surprise, or at least not the most expected outcome. But I think that it may have stayed a little bit longer in the news cycle over here, because a few days later, we saw reports coming out that the U.S. was considering pulling back from EITI commitments as well. Now, the officials from the Department of the Interior have denied these reports so far from a handful of NGOs. But if the U.S. does go through with pulling back on its commitments to the EITI, does that have any substantial impact on EITI in and of itself? Or is there a reason to think that EITI would be able to continue on and even expand if the U.S. does pull out of its commitments?
Well, first I want to say I certainly hope that the U.S. does not withdraw. That would certainly, from our perspective, be the backtracking that we wouldn't like to see. We, of course, hope that the U.S. continues to demonstrate its leadership on transparency and accountability issues and anti-corruption measures. So I hope they don't take that step. If they were to go down that route, I think that the EITI has grown as an initiative, again, now 50-odd countries strong. I think that this initiative has taken root in countries in a way and has a commitment from so many stakeholders on the ground that hopefully the benefits of the initiative are no longer considered in any circles a donor-driven or northern-driven initiative, but that they are truly something that local stakeholders find beneficial, and that's why they do it. So from that perspective, I hope it wouldn't have an impact. But I definitely think in terms of sending a message at this critical time on the U.S.'s positioning on transparency and anti-corruption issues, I think it's significant, but hopefully the initiative would be able to withstand it.
Okay. So one of the things you mentioned just a little bit ago pertained to recent developments in the EITI. And Erica, just as a final question, you know, one of the things you mentioned was a recent emphasis on beneficial ownership, for example, and contract transparency. Where is the EITI going from here? What are the next areas of growth for transparency, either at least within the EITI or maybe even more broadly within transparency in the extractive sector moving forward?
Where I hope the transparency movement goes, including the EITI, is really a focus on figuring out how all of these pieces of information join up together and can be used more smartly in a comprehensive way. I think we've seen a lot of targeted pushes on different specific disclosures, and I think that moved the goalpost in a way that needed to happen. But I think now we're in a phase where we can really start thinking about how, and it will vary for different countries, again, based on different contexts, but how these different pieces of information can be best analyzed together to improve policy debate, to improve policy making through the analysis of data. So I hope that we start seeing more joined up data, more timely data, and I hope that we just see the disclosure processes themselves, and this is a big part of EITI's kind of next phase, we use this term mainstreaming, essentially moving away from sort of standalone reporting and becoming more fully embedded into the day-to-day operations of the way government and company and civil society interact on these issues. So that transparency norms kind of transitions from the standalone, you know, EITI reports into fully embedded ways of operating that are themselves transparent and kind of joined up. So I hope that can be kind of the next phase. I think there's a lot of opportunity there, but I think the critical thing with any sort of data-related, mainstreamed approach is that we can't forget this multi-stakeholder element. There's a reason that it's presented so many challenges, even in challenging situations like Azerbaijan, because the heart and core of what makes initiatives like this unique is that multi-stakeholder element. So we have to find a way of moving forward with the transparency element, but also keeping that public debate, public dialogue, bringing different stakeholders together as a key part of it as well.